Welcome to Teach Right, the podcast for first-time instructors, experienced instructors, and anyone else interested in the teaching of writing. I'm Daniel Anderson, and we're coming to you from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Today, we're going to be talking about the writing process, and we'll look at an introduction to a book by Hannah Rule. The book is called Situating Writing Processes. I have several guests who are going to be leading the conversation today, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Gray Underwood, Department of English and Comparative Literature, focus in film studies.
Tyler Elrod, the Department of English and Comparative Literature. I study 19th century American literature.
Simone Sparks, Department of English and Comparative Literature. I study rhetoric and composition.
I'm Mitch Lucido. I am with all of these in the Department of English and Comparative Lit at UNC. I study critical game studies.
And I'm Charlotte Scott. I'm in the same department as everyone else. I'm specifically in the comparative literature track, and I'm interested in speculative fiction, especially in English and Spanish.
Fantastic. Well, welcome, everyone. Today, we're talking about the writing process, and we read an article in advance of this conversation. It was actually the introduction to a book. The book is called Situating Writing Processes by Hannah Rule. And I thought I'd start us out with a quotation. It says, and when I look around to take stock of process in this moment, I see it in a contradictory position, one of vague disinterest and steady persistence. And I think this quote speaks to the way that concepts like the writing process become naturalized in education in some ways. So it's an important concept. It's an important activity in writing classes, the writing process, but it also maybe gets overlooked, or there's this element of disinterest. So this two-sided nature of the writing process is one thing that jumped out to me in the piece. And is that something you all picked up on? And is it an accurate description of how the field of writing thinks about the writing process?
From the perspective of somebody who's putting together a syllabus, I think a lot of these ideas of process are something that I sort of take for granted, especially when I'm thinking about putting together an assignment. So if I am working them up to a larger essay or something, I'm often going to give them smaller feeder assignments or homework assignments that are built at sort of scaffolding a process for them. And I think that while my intention might be I'm trying to show you potential ways of getting there, that my position as instructor insinuates that that is the process that exists. That when I ask students to say, give me an outline or do a free write and then give me an outline and then write a draft and then we're going to peer review that draft and then here's the final, that's the scope and or that's the way that the writing process unfolds or how it should unfold, especially for newer writers. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about what Rule says is asking us to think about that sort of question of like how do we get across to students that the process is not such a hardline thing, even though it might appear that way because it appears in a syllabus or it appears from me as professor instructor, right? That there's like that level of power and experience.
I think like I appreciate that because something I kind of was thinking about by the end of the reading, and I think maybe I was just feeling like really tired and like defeated and bad, but I was like, I can't escape the writing classroom. Like I can't ignore the fact that this institution like talks through me or something, like, and that institution is always going to like naturalize the like outer limit being like a certain form that claims to be doing process, but really is just like another sort of like naturalized, like objective like means that doesn't really create a lot of avenues for process or the kind of reflective thinking that I think the author wants students to access. So I don't know, I guess maybe that kind of speaks to what you were saying. I don't know, but not to like jump all the way to like defeatist like institutional paradigms, but like that is where I was left.
I mean, for me as a total first-time teacher, like I haven't even TA'd writing students before. I've just been a writing tutor one-on-one. Sort of a good thing, but also a stressful thing about this process of teaching 105 has been how open it really is. And so I'm trying to work in some aspects and elements of reflection for my students. But it's strange, especially as a first timer, to realize how much of my writing process is still like opaque and confusing to me.
Yeah, so true.
And that's especially something that I've been thinking through in the past year, coming back to academia or back to school after a couple years off where I was doing essentially no writing. And so I think that it's like difficult because in addition to the pressures of needing to teach students specific outcomes as vague as they sometimes are, we are also trying to figure out the best way that we would even integrate something like process. And Rule just emphasizes again and again how incapable it is to like codify that. And I wasn't familiar with the whole idea of a post-process sort of shift, but the way she explains it, that's partly in response to the understanding that process is just too complicated, too different, varies too much from person to person to ever truly be set down as something that we can teach our students. So you can't just teach your students, quote unquote, how to write according to this process. And I think that the question of what do you teach your students then? How can you teach them to write? Is kind of something I was left with. And it seems like she's questioning the attitude of the post-process sort of perspective that abandons process but doesn't actually supply an alternative or doesn't actually address the hole that would be left if you just took process out of the writing curriculum entirely.
Dan, I like the term you used earlier, double-sided, because it kind of reflects my feelings about sort of the proposals that are being put forth here about teaching writing process, because one of the things that's mentioned throughout the reading is that the whole idea of teaching writing process is overlooked generally in writing classes, which I absolutely agree with. And I think that there's far too little attention paid to sort of talking about how to go about, you know, building a writing process for yourself. But at the same time, I worry about being too didactic about it, because especially for students that maybe, you know, are new to writing or don't write very much, I worry that if you give them sort of like a formalized set of instructions and then they go home and then they try it out and they find out that that doesn't work for them, then I worry that they shut down and they just think, oh, I'm a bad writer, you know. So it's a double-edged sword, and it's a balancing thing for sure.
I think something Mitch said, his first comment about taking it for granted, really hit close to home for me, because I'm coming in with an MA, so I've taught a Composition 1 class a couple of times at another university. And it always struck me that I would just launch into lessons and launch into instruction and sort of not realize that I already had a process and that maybe they didn't as first-time writers or first-time academic, you know, college writers, and that was something maybe I needed to talk about, not just for them, but also for myself, to become more conscious of my writing process as it changes. Because, you know, as graduate students, our schedules are different every single semester. So for me, I like to have a period of time I work every single day, maybe, you know, let's say like 10 to 1 or something, just as an example. And that might not be possible from semester to semester. So what's been really helpful, both for me and I think for my students, is to record my own writing process and then to show them how it's changed and sort of impart unto them that they don't have to be quite so rigid with their own process, that if they ever need to fluctuate, they can do so.
Yeah, I think a couple of things there that make a lot of sense, and I sort of appreciate you thinking about, because when I write, I don't want to have my 10 to 1 every single day. That's like, that's when I'm sitting down and writing, because I write in spurts. But something that kind of cracks me up about me saying that is Hannah Rule herself on page 8 says, our process discourses continue to shimmer with a modernist aura of writing as transcendent mind work that is somehow irrespective of particular bodies, actions, objects, and spaces. And I find it quite ironic, I think, reading and thinking about my own experience with process, because I almost embody that sort of feeling about how I go through the writing process, right, while simultaneously right, talking out of the other side of my mouth
that's
to my students
say
and like, saying, yeah, saying
like I don't want to know what I do. Like, why don't I have to tell you? Like, you should know what you do, but I don't need to know. Like, I'm the teacher. Like,
like it's not important that to finish that seminar paper the other yeah, semester, I just like wrote from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. Like, that's not important.
Yeah, it's actually, I can't tell you because I can't legally advocate for
yeah, and so those sorts of moments are interesting, but I love this idea of like just jumping into a lesson, mm-hmm, because I came to UNC with a bit of writing experience, but I taught at a couple of different universities that thought about the writing classroom very differently. Mm-hmm. One of the universities that I was at, in fact, like they handed me a syllabus, taught me day by day, like told me day by day, this is what you're teaching. These are the readings that you're assigning. These are the assignments that you're assigning. And there was a reliance perhaps on, say, like classical rhetoric as sort of the underpinning to all of what was being taught there. So, you know, I'm running in and I'm drawing I'm talking about ethos and logos and pathos. I'm talking about sort of like classical ways of putting together an essay and things like that, which is just a way of thinking about a writing process that's very divorced perhaps from my own. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this one now, but you know, there's all of these different ways to approach what's happening, and that level of reflective mm-hmm, nature as a teacher, I think, is really important, because I was sitting there just upset that somebody was telling me exactly what I needed to teach, but that I don't think was ultimately why I was upset. I think I was ultimately upset because I didn't like the idea of this is the way that you learn writing, mm-hmm, and this is the one correct way of doing it, because mm-hmm, I don't know if that exists.
Yeah, sort of the one of the sort of strategies I've used up to this point in my teaching career is, rather than teaching process as like a, you know, multi-step thing, I like to give sort of little generalized bits of advice related to the process. Like, I tell my students that writer's block doesn't exist, that it's sort of it's a result of reticence and unreasonable expectation, and that in terms of fear over sitting down and writing a first draft, you know, it's about lowering expectations and realizing that, you know, I always tell my students also that, you know, a first draft is always going to be crap, you know, no matter what it is, and it doesn't matter your level of skill, if you're, you know, a first-time writer, if you're, you know, Mark Twain, you know, the first thing that you put on a page is always going to be sort of stream of consciousness and disorganized. And I feel like that's where a lot of, excuse me, that's where a lot of students get bogged down, is with fear and hesitation over actually just sitting down and laying out a first draft. I always try to highlight the fact that writing is, you know, it's all about revision and what you end up with your final, which is, of course, why it's always better to, not always practical for students, depending on their schedule, but, you know, to write a first draft several days in advance and then take those next couple days to go through and look at it again and again and revise and proofread. And, you know, obviously that's not an option when you have students that, you know, wait until the night before. But, yeah, that's, I just like to sort of give general sort of tidbits of process-based advice rather than sort of like, this is what you do. You sit down, you do this, you do this, you do this, and then you have, you know, your paper. You know, so
I like that you tell them that, honestly, because I also found that coming out of my mouth like 2 days ago. I was like, oh, okay, cool, this is advice I'm giving right now, you know. But like, that like writer's block doesn't exist. Like I remember the first time a writing instructor told me that, and I was like, what? Like just like melting into the ground. Like, oh, like I don't know what I'm gonna say before I say it. Like it happens as I write it, or that I know what I know, or whatever. Just being like, this is my whole reality. Like the first time a therapist tells you that both things can be true, and you're just like, my entire worldview is like fucked now. So I think that's great advice. Like, I don't know, that can just unlock so much, I think.
Yeah, it really opens up space to talk about like ugly feelings, the feelings we're not supposed to have when we're writing, you know?
Yeah.
Frustrate. Like that was a big one. One of the activities I like to do early on is have my students reflect on what their writing process physically looks like. Like what do they drink when they're doing it? How are they feeling? Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's why I love this article, Mitch, is a couple of sentences, especially early on, really were totally what I like to do with my students, in the sense that I have them think about the material conditions that they find themselves in. And then we talk about feelings, and I say, this is always the most popular, I say, who feels frustrated when they write? And like everybody raises their hands, you know? So it really gives them space to understand that it's okay to be frustrated, and that like even at the doctoral level, when you're writing, it's extremely frustrating and incredibly difficult. And how often do you sit down in a room alone with just your thoughts? I mean, you know, maybe you've got some noise, like music on or a TV show or something, but like you really spend that much time with yourself one-on-one. Very rarely, you know. And so I think that it's hard for me. I think it's hard for them. And it's fun to get that out in the opening class.
Are there other assignments? You go ahead. I'm talking too much. But I'm like dying to, like my big pressing question that I hope we get to at some point, if not now or later, is like other assignment prompts that can help with that. Because I honestly feel like I need those. Like, I don't know. And there's so many options.
One that I sort of discovered impromptu was that I had a student say that we read The Learning Curve by David Sedaris. And in that, he talks about a lot of his failings as a creative writing instructor. And specifically one of those failings was having them do in-class writing on a subject off the cuff. And I had a student say, yeah, I actually really hate that. I hate when someone tells me to like take 10 minutes to write about a desk. So we talked about it. And I said, okay, well, now we're going to take 10 minutes to do Aura's favorite assignment, which is to write about a thing off the cuff, and sort of like force them to be in this state of almost, you know, discomfort, maybe. I mean, let's just say discomfort, and get used to writing in different ways that they might not be familiar with or even enjoy. But, you know, 10 minutes and it's over and we did it. And now maybe you're a little more patient with yourself in that situation, or a little more comfortable with something you previously didn't enjoy doing.
Wait, so Sedaris says his failing was the free write.
Yeah. Damn, among many failings.
Oh, no.
I do, too. Yeah. I don't think it's...
I don't think I'm going to stop, but maybe I need to read that piece.
Well, I think ultimately an important part of a practice like that, as you're sort of describing, is that move to think back about the experience of doing that, right? That your student was open and said, I hate doing this. I think it's actually really, I think it's a really great, this is going to sound really kind of backwards, but that's like a really awesome thing to instill in a student. And it's kind of an undercurrent that I have, that I feel about perhaps teaching writing in general, but I kind of get through rules piece, is this question of how do we get students to take some sort of ownership over their work. I think at one point Rule asks us about this idea of like, how does a student actually come to their own writing and like experience of writing if I'm always looking over their shoulder at their draft? And I don't know, I guess I want to just sort of ask you guys more generally, like what are your moves about trying to instill maybe not that confidence, but that like degree to which this writing is mine feeling from a student, which even if that this writing is mine feeling is I hate this version of writing, but like how do we get there?
excuse me. I like to point out, you know, it was either the first or second class this semester that I told my students that I like to point out the fact that writing is one of the only free art forms, in the sense that you don't need a camera and a bunch of equipment. You don't need a canvas and expensive paints. You don't need ballet shoes, you know. All you need to write is a pen and paper or a laptop.
Laptop's admittedly not free.
That's
yeah,
true.
I'm like, tell this true. To the sophists. They didn't fucking write anything
yeah.
down.
I'm sorry, if I can't
but you know, I mean, pen and paper. So, you know, you and you can write something that you don't want anyone to see. You know, you can write something that you can then throw in someone's fireplace and let mm-hmm. it, you know. So you that gives mm-hmm. you that sense of freedom and agency. You know, you whether you enjoy writing and you want to do it, you know, 12 hours a day, or it's something that you dread doing, it's always there for you. And you, you know, you always have a voice and you have a means of expressing it that is not, you know, that you don't have to go out of your way to find the means of doing, essentially.
I do like the whole, like, my friend who's a drummer said this to me the other day, that I was like, oh, I always wanted to play the drums, like I'm Matt. And they were like, what do you mean? It comes with the package. You're a human being. You know how to do that, or something. So it's like, if somebody's like, I don't know how to write, it's like it kind of came with the what
it's
you
already,
got. Yeah.
It's already installed.
I promise that's pretty much pre-installed, like, by this point. Like, thanks, Ong, or whatever. I don't know. Yeah.
So one of the things that I'm hearing is a kind of individualism in some ways, and I don't know if I'm going to articulate this correctly, but what I heard a little bit was a link between writing and identity, or writing and ownership, maybe writing and thinking. And I can see how those are really positive directions in which to go. Here's why you should value this writing, and maybe even build a process in, because it's who you are, it's your own thinking, you have this kind of ownership. But I'm wondering if that actually goes against some of the points that Rule is making about how writing is situated and social. She talks about it as, you know, being instantiated in material places, connected with others, shaped by culture, all of these sorts of things. So, you know, again, this double-edged kind of approach to it, we're talking about our writing process as this individual thing, and how do we bring more of that context? I think Rule is saying, bring the context. How do we get that into the mix?
So I don't want to do the, like, I have my cake and eat it too situation here, but I feel like those two things are not mutually exclusive,
right?
Because I do think that some amount of getting students to pay attention to the materiality of what they're doing, mm-hmm. to experience writing as Rule says, like, as a verb instead of as a noun, mm-hmm. is, for me, crucial to developing a level of perhaps what you call individualism. The term I've used in the past is, like, ownership, and I don't love that as a term, because I don't think it's quite getting at, it's like, I want them to embody the mm-hmm. writing that they're doing, because I want them to feel that when they are writing, they are writing. I don't feel equipped
There's
with, like, the good language to describe what I'm saying, but that's yeah. sort of the move that I want to make. And
so
I think
maybe something like identification with their own writing, like mm-hmm. the sense that it's part of them.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about it is in terms of agency. Like, just because you recognize the agency of others doesn't mean that you also don't have your own sense of agency, especially when it comes to the writing process. And, you know, I was talking to Dan a little bit before this in a private conference, but I like to assign Ursula K. Le Guin's carrier bag theory.
So good.
Yeah, and so, like, have them thinking about this idea of, like, writing as a container, but also themselves as a container. And so you're constantly interacting with others and taking things from their container and putting into yours, and giving things to them
so
that
nice.
They can put in their container. And so, you know, recognizing the influences that others have had on you, and then maybe how there's, like, a lineage of influences, right, like, down the writing chain. So your agency is just sort of added to the agencies of others, I think, is a good way to conceptualize it.
Yeah, agency, I think, is a phenomenal term, especially because so much of what we do, at least in 105 classes, right, is we're really interested in rhetorical situations mm-hmm. and genre questions. Mm-hmm. And I think agency plays really well into that, because we're asking these students to make these sorts of choices about the work that they're doing. Ultimately, we want them to be able to go into a rhetorical situation and have the agency in their writing to say, okay, this is the type of thing that I need to do here. Or, actually, I know that this is what I'm supposed to typically do, but I actually want to do this other thing and make that purposeful choice. At the beginning of the semester, I love challenging my students to write a like one sentence paragraph at some point, because that's not typically like an academic thing. And I always tell them, like, you're never going to find a way to do this. And it's like a way of sort of getting them to just think like, okay, wait, how am I constructing a paragraph? What is it that I can do to make that one sentence paragraph work and be rhetorically effective? And it's mm-hmm. trying to build that agency, if by roundabout sort of nefarious yeah. means.
I like to tie it into just personal interaction too. I mean, at a certain point, it becomes a subconscious thing where, you know, we're always using rhetorical strategies, you know, whenever we're engaging in a discourse with anyone or whenever we're writing anything, there's always a rhetorical mode that we're using. And, you know, at a certain point, it becomes less about, it's like, am I using logos, ethos, and pathos? Am I, you know, what sort of rhetorical strategy am I using? It becomes more about, like, what point am I trying to make? What argument am I trying to make? So then it becomes a, you know, sort of like a, an automatic process that we're doing at a certain point where, you know, we're not specifically dwelling on or choosing like what rhetorical mode we're using. It's just, you know, sort of an automatic thing.
Yeah. But I think that there's like a point at which that some of these skills become internalized mm-hmm. and some of the ideas become internalized, and then they can become invisible, which is again good because it means you can draw on them without trying so hard. But the flip side is that it can be harder to identify what's going on. And as I think about my own writing process, there are certain skills that I don't even acknowledge as being like easy for me or easier, because it's they sort of disappear. And what becomes clear to me is all of the things that I struggle with. So like this, the parts of my writing process that right now, at least that I'm most aware of, are the ones that I haven't figured out yet, I guess is what I'm saying. And thinking about, I haven't read the Le Guin piece, but what I'm guessing is what it's about, and thinking about our discussion of the context versus individualism, I feel like there's always going to be like an interaction there, because every student is already an individual, whether they know anything about writing or not, whether or not you're teaching them a writing class. Like there is always a moment where that student and their experiences and their thoughts and their mood that day mm-hmm. comes up against whatever the material is in the class. And so like the question of how porous that boundary is, ideally, hopefully they get something out of the discussions in the class and like what we're talking about and what we're trying to teach them. Mm-hmm. But I think that's always there. Like Mitch, you were saying, like, it's not one or the other. And so in a certain way, making someone more aware of their own ideas and their pre-existing assumptions about writing, their own experiences, like how their mood affects how they approach writing mm-hmm. is actually helpful to arm them as they then can decide how they want to take on like a task in a specific context with that specific rhetorical situation. For you specifically, what is the most effective or interesting way to approach this specific assignment or this specific requirement? Because every student could approach that same thing a different way.
I'm definitely with Chantal Mouffe on neoliberalism has stolen away a productive idea of the individual subject. So I'm like, it's okay if they're sort of juggling around in their own mind, like it's not their fault that maybe that leads them to unproductive, you know, isolated politics or something. But I guess something I found productive at one point, to go back to like Dan's question as well, of like the sort of like how do we get students to see themselves as part of a collective while also becoming sort of like localized in their purview? Like one funny thing I've been doing is every time a student just like clearly embraces their sort of limited subjective like take on the world, I have a dog now, so I'm always thinking of like, okay, here's a treat. So I'll always, yeah, I don't know, like every time it happens, I'm just like
conditioning your
yeah, I know, I think that's good. I'm thinking about operant conditioning. It's making me really nice. No, but I don't know. So like, I've just been, you know, trying to tell them like, that was great, you know, or whatever. I don't know, like Gold Star or something. But like, but at the same time, I'm just like, come on, people, like, you exist in the context meme, like, or whatever. So it's like, one other assignment that I'm really dying to do again that I think maybe worked for this is I had the students take a paper they were writing, and they were doing a Disso Logoi project, which is like the art of arguing on multiple sides of the same position, which for me, I love that assignment just because it really gets them like just completely like short-circuiting about their biases, I guess, which can be a, you know, one way of engaging with collectivity is just like really getting real about that. But I think I had them map their positions into characters. Like I had them like write fictional characters for their arguments and like describe them and give them like personalities and like interests and like stuff like that. And I think that that was sort of one thing that I remember seeing like a vast improvement in their writing afterward, or maybe not in their writing, but in their thinking and their thinking about themselves and their self-awareness, I guess, self-awareness. It's like, also, I feel like what's at stake with what we're talking about is like subjecthood or something. So like all of these words are so fraught and I know that, but it's like, yeah. So I don't know. It's something like that. Maybe I've saw being sort of like productive, I guess.
Well, that's, I think you're getting something really interesting too with the writing process in like a composition one class is like, this is the first time they're in college. A lot of times it's probably the smallest class they're in to begin with. Right. Like their first semester of fall. Mm-hmm. They're also kind of learning who they are and what kind of person they are.
Very cute.
And so, yeah, like I think your point about like being better thinkers, not necessarily better writers grammatically or better writers from an argumentation standpoint, but better thinkers. I think that's really important too. And that is a sort of sign of, you know, quote unquote success in the composition classroom.
So I think this actually brings us to Rule's essay. Rule's introduction here is sweeping and it moves in a bunch of different directions and it's taking on a number of theoretical places. One of those that she gets to like at the bottom of 14, when she's talking about this question of like, is her methodology process oriented, a post process oriented, she says, I take no issue with this brand of post process break as disciplinary expansion, right? She's talking about how do we imagine what a writing classroom does. She's interested in pedagogy. And she says, for many reasons that include and well exceed the influence of post-process thinking, including, for instance, ongoing focus on global Englishes, community writing, public writing, writing across the lifespan, workplace writing, non-Western and cultural rhetorics, and many other burgeoning areas of scholarly focus, our field's considerations of writing now undoubtedly exceed college instructional concerns alone. Mm-hmm. Continuing on. Post-process discourse, in other words, is often entwined with resistance to the so-called pedagogical imperative. A little bit later, she says, this resistance, as also invoked elsewhere, claims that composition should let go of college writing instruction as its disciplinary center and with it any concerns all about, quote, application. Indeed, I agree. Writing theory or research should not be beholden automatically to classroom application. And I think that's the heart of this question is like, what are we attempting to do?
Make them go home and journal and love it.
In the 105 space.
That's a win.
But yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a degree, at least from what the two of y'all are saying, about like, we can find a win in what we're doing in 105 if we've just helped these students self-actualize a little bit, or if we've helped them become people who are ready to think in the ways that they're going to need to do, not just in college, but for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm.
I want to actually comment on that because it's tough when you start to weave the theory and the pedagogy together a little bit, because what I get from the theory in here is that kind of institutional involvement, materiality, objects that you're connected with are hugely important. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a situation that has more of that going on than first year composition at a university. There's no more institutionality than any of that, except maybe the admissions essays. So if you really want students to learn to navigate that and recognize it, then it seems like first year composition would be a wonderful kind of petri dish for you to experiment in that way. And I know there's all kinds of writing outside of first year composition, but I'm just having a little bit of trouble walking away from all the richness that you've all been talking about for the last 30 minutes about what you can discover in this class and the opportunities, because it's an institutional entity. And and it also is this problematic gesture of people trying to decouple themselves from the institutions that they're involved in, but, you know, still having to pay the rent and, you know, all of these other things. We're all here because of first year composition. So can we use it as a lens for these kinds of outcomes we're looking for?
I think my, maybe it's my, like, trying to be sympathetic to what Rule is getting at here, is that my reading is, like, it's almost less, I don't think she has a problem with the, I think she finds an incredible usefulness maybe in a first year composition course. The question is, it's, like, external pressures in the institution, which is that if... one of my students goes off and they write a lab report in a bio class and it's just completely missing the mark. The tendency for an instructor over there in the bio, like in the biology discipline, to come back and say, well, what are you guys teaching them in 105 that they can't write this lab report for me? So those sorts of like expectations are sort of lumped on top of us. I find it personally, I find like, it's a little, I feel like there's a lot of pressure as...
I would just be like, sorry, I cracked them open like I'm supposed to, and now they're scrambling about what to say. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know...
Yeah, I often teach, I often have my students read a lot about, like, the concept of standardized English. So I have them read a collection of essays, or like op-ed articles that Stanley Fish writes, basically saying like all we should be teaching is standardized English. We should be really hearkening in on grammar. And then I have them read a response by a scholar named Vrishana Shanti Young, who writes this really wonderful, dense article in African-American vernacular English, responding, being like, actually, we should think about how people are constantly sort of what he claims code meshing, is this like sliding between vernaculars and languages and things like that. And part of sort of the thing that I'm trying to get them at here is like, what is the ultimate purpose of their writing that they're doing here? Am I teaching them to like write a good cover letter when they leave? Am I teaching them to write a good academic paper in their sociology class next semester? Like, what's the ultimate goal? And so I try to distill that all the way down to language and like, how are we interacting with language? But there's so many directions to go. I'm interested.
You have to like rapidly toggle between both worlds, I think, where it's like, I mean, like you're, I think it goes back to what we were talking about with agency too, where it's like these students, my hope is that they don't like naturalize the resume or professional writing as the only way that writing can operate in their life. But at the same time, I want them to be really good at it so they can like survive in the, in education and be good writers, you know?
Sorry, I didn't mean
that. No, you're fine.
I think it's about stoking passion too, because people like writing about what they're interested in, and everybody has something that they're sort of consumed with or very passionate about. And so I think, you know, teaching them to, you know, giving them the option and sort of the freedom with some of the assignments to sort of pick a subject and write about it. And I think that feeling of, you know, when you're passionate about something, you tend to write well about it, in, at least in my experience. And so that sort of feeling of victory that they get from being able to write like an essay about, you know, a film or a sports team or an album, you know, whatever, you know, what have you. I think that that sort of carries over into other types of writing where, you know, like business writing or, you know, something where maybe it's not their chief interest, but they kind of, you know, they realize, okay, you know, I know that I can write well, and so those skills sort of transfer over. I think it's really just about getting them to have at least one, you know, one good sense of like victory of, you know, I was able to write well about something, and so I know I can do it. And so it's just a matter of finding a process that works for me and putting in the intellectual work.
Yeah, that thought process is really helpful. Again, especially to me as the most first-timer out of this group, I certainly feel like, Mitch, you were saying, the pressure of trying to fulfill all of the demands of of teaching this course. In some ways, it's easier because, oh, it's just like your first year. It's just a bunch of first years. It's their first writing course. But then the pressure at the same time is this is their first writing course. Mm-hmm. So trying to get them to, like, all the time you spend explaining an assignment, explaining, for example, CSE citation format, which is a format that I didn't even know. So I had to teach myself, and then you're teaching the students, and all the time you spend with the practicalities, then there's the textbook and the larger rhetorical ideas, which again is new in a sense to me. I'm not, like, I haven't read the textbook cover to cover. I didn't read it before getting here, obviously. So, like, all of those competing demands can make it difficult to know, at least in my case, what is the best use of my time, and that I don't want to spend all of my time just telling them about an assignment. I want the classroom to be a community, so that's a value that's important to me, mm-hmm. increasing their sense of efficacy and agency, building this that their belief in themselves to get resources, get help, ask other people. And so it's hard to know exactly how to balance all of that. But I like the idea of having at least one writing assignment where they feel like they've succeeded by whatever metric is important to them, and trying to empower them, because it's kind of like with the job market. They say so many of the skills that you learn are actually on the job. I think, like, so many of the things you need to write a lab report are things that we can't teach them in 105. And, like, those are things that they should be learning in the class, because each class is its own situation again.
Yeah, I think all this discussion of pressure, too, and I don't want to stray too far into another topic, like away from the writing process, but I think pressure is something that, as instructors, we can address in the classroom as part of our sort of class ethos. Like, one thing that's really helped me with that, especially, let's take it to, like, 105, has been the freedom to do contract grading for the first time officially. In my previous institution, we weren't allowed to do that. So I had this weird hybrid of, like, traditional grading and contract grading that was more contract grading, but I couldn't call it that, right? Here I can call it that, and here I can engage with my students at that level and say, listen, let's take the pressure of a grade away. This class is about practice, and this class is about, you know, Mitch, as you said, self-actualizing. Like, this class is about realizing who you are as a writer and all the sort of, like, networks that can come from. And, you know, part of that is maybe for them, like, these students are really driven and they really want to do well. Like, maybe part of that is saying, I'm not gonna roast you in your grades. Like, you do this, you work hard, you, like, show me that you want to get better at writing and you make a genuine effort and you know, like, you're going to do fine. Like, let's just not worry about that pressure of grading. Let's just have fun. I think that has, at least in my class, and this is my first class at UNC, my first class doing contract grading, but it seems to have helped a little bit so far, and they seem to be more willing to certainly engage. And, you know, another thing is I don't take up every writing assignment. I very rarely take up writing assignments. I'll have them free write and just, that's for you. That's not for me at all. Like, I'm not going to look at that. We'll talk about it in class, but
I think that's savvy. I don't know. Yeah, because they will. Because even if you say it's not for you, they'll still write it to you. Mm-hmm. Unless you're like, I'm actually literally not going to read this. Yeah. Which is kind of funny. I don't know. I'm also doing contract grading for the first time. Which beforehand, yeah, I did, like, a traditional grading, but I was approaching it like contract grading, yeah, which I think was worse. I think it was more unethical because there actually wasn't an explicit contract, like an agreement.
Yeah.
And then students would read it as casual, and then they would do things that were objectively failing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, now I have to give you, I just think you should take this class again. Like, mm-hmm. I have to give you a bad grade on this. Versus now it's like, I'm so glad to be doing contract grading. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It's so nice. I'm watching their biases just, like, shed off. You know what I mean? Like, they're constant. But I think it's sort of, it's nice. They keep on scrambling and asking me for, like, parameters for stuff. And I'm like, guys, like, I've told you, like, I will give you those parameters. And I think that on the second unit assignment, I'm just going to give the most, like, punishingly specific prompt ever. Because I'm like, now they're kind of like, I don't know what to do now that I'm, like, not trying to, like, fulfill the, like, ACT constraints or whatever. Yeah. But it is really fun. I don't know. I'm glad that we can do it.
Yeah, the way that I've sort of handled it is I'm still doing traditional grading in regard to their final drafts of their feeders and their unit projects, but I'm not grading their drafts, their first drafts. So it's like, you know, you get a first draft that you bring in for peer review, it gets peer reviewed, and then I give you my 2 cents. You know, I'll give you a little bit of feedback. And of course, I'm always there in class during peer review if you have specific questions or concerns. And so that's sort of your time to, and I've also told them to sort of, during those peer review sessions, to sort of treat the class as like a writer's room almost. You know, if, if you think about like a writer's room for a TV studio or film studio, you know, you're getting feedback, you're bouncing ideas back and forth. And so you're getting all this practice and feedback, and then you go and, you know, iron out this final draft and turn that in based on the feedback that you've gotten both from your peers and from me, and then that's what gets graded. So it's kind of like, I don't know, I've kind
of... seems productive.
Yeah, I try to sort of fall in the middle there a little bit in terms of, like, I guess a little bit of contract grading element, but also you're still using the traditional model, and we'll see how that works. I may decide that it's ineffective and change it next semester, but
yeah, that's why I decided to do it this time, because I was like, I just need to see this through to see if this is something I want to keep doing, which is nice. Yeah.
So. Well, ultimately, kind of what it feels like is at stake for us in this conversation about grading, and I don't want to put words in all your mouths, but some stuff that you were saying, Simone, was
feel
just
free.
Like, okay. Actually, what Simone was saying.
Yeah.
And I think this is the place, this overlaps with the thing that I take away from Rule's article the most, or introduction. At the bottom of 12, she says, more than learning writing processes, physically situating processes is to learn how to learn to respond to changing conditions in which writing finds itself, is putting in the hands of writers themselves, aka our students, not the yields of our process inquiry, but its questions and observational methods. And I think the moves that the three of you were all kind of talking about is an effort to say, look, there's this writing that you're doing that's existing for you as a student to learn how to learn. I'm actually not even going to pick up that paper that I asked you to, like, I'm not picking up the sheet of paper that you just wrote on for 10 minutes. This homework assignment that I'm giving you, I'm actually just, because I want you to think about the thing and I want you to come to class and turn to a partner and talk about it. Mm-hmm. I want you to, like, be actively engaged in that experience of trying to figure out kind of what works. And I think that's the hopeful thing, or the thing that I read from Rule that I try to take with me, whether or not I'm doing it well, who knows. But I think that's the part of, there's a lot to this introduction, I think, that goes in a lot of wildly different places and talks about things that are kind of beyond maybe the scope of what we're thinking about, especially in this conversation, just like pedagogy versus theory that Dan was mentioning before. But I think that's the one thing that ultimately I try to take to heart, and why I like this introduction a lot, is that attentiveness, I think, plays out really nicely as a means for what we're trying to do in this class, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to do all of the things that maybe the pressure is asking me to do, but maybe what I can do is try and find a way to teach my students to learn how to learn, to do something.
So true.
Well, what a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed this last 40 minutes. It's been amazing. And I think, you know, what I heard is that processes are actually playing out in these classes in a lot of ways. And to Rule's credit, she points us to looking at those as kind of situated, individualized, differentiated, responsive. And I think what I love about this is it turns out that a lot of times people are more closely on the same page than they often think they are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the big zoomed out aspects of our course is something called the rhetorical situation. And I don't hear that too much differently than what we've just been talking about. It's differentiated, it's individualized. And if you can learn to navigate those and move from one to another and have success in one, then that kind of fluidity is going to be really helpful as you move through here. And I think the same thing holds true for something like writing process. If you zoom in too far, yes, those general rules don't make any sense. But if we zoom out enough, then we can say, yes, processes are important, but we need to situate them just as Rule is saying, and it all comes together. But I thank you all for bringing all of these points to the surface, because I think the conversation was both illuminating in getting those parameters out, but also really pragmatic as you were talking about your assignments and everything else as well. So Thank you, everyone. I really enjoyed the conversation. And everyone who's listening, tune in next time as we take up another topic on Teach Right.